Well, it's great to be here, be back, and to share with you in this series called Growing. The first part of this series, and this will be the final one, is about what God does and how we respond to Him for our growth. The next part of the series is what we do, and then God responds to us. There's part that we respond and part that God responds. When I was just a kid in public school, we lived beside a yard that a lumber company had bought, and they stored lumber there. Now, nobody worked there. Trucks would come in, and they would drop off lumber and stack it all in all kinds of different stacks according to how much they had and the kind of lumber, and then they would drive out, which then made it a perfect playground for the rest of us kids that were in the neighborhood. And we used to be there all the time. And one of our favorite games was called chicken. And I'm sure you get it. Somebody would make a jump. They would yell, chicken. And then we'd all come around and then they'd make a jump. And you had three chances to make that jump or to chicken out. And if you didn't make it or you chickened out, you were out of the game. And of course, the final person that wasn't going to the hospital or that had made the jump and nobody else would make, they were the winner. And of all the times we played that game, there's one time I remember really clearly. I was tall when I was a kid, too, so I could often make the jumps. And so I was usually one of the people that was near the end of the game of chicken. But there was one jump one kid called, and it was like a stack of lumber that was probably about, I think it was 20 feet tall when I was that age. But it was probably only about eight or 10 feet high. And then there was another stack that was probably about 4 or 5 feet high, and we were to jump down onto that. And that doesn't sound that hard, except there was another stack that was probably 12 feet high, and the corner of that stack came out, and you had to kind of jump around the corner while you were coming down to the other side. And so the first guy, Bobby, he did the jump, and I thought that was pretty cool. And then Kenny did the jump, and then it was my turn, and I was standing there, and I could not get over the fact of that corner sticking out. And I was sure I was going to hit that corner and then fall on my head, which I didn't want to do. And so as I was standing there, I kept screwing up my courage, and I'd get ready, and then I'd go to jump, and then I'd back down. And three times I did that until finally the kid behind me said, "What are you waiting for?" Now, I don't think the kid behind me meant, "Hey, Ed, let's just talk about your fears here, and let's work our way through it, and I'll help you as you try to make this jump." No, I can't even remember the kid that was behind me. The kid was like, "Will you hurry up? Will you either jump or get out of the way? I want to go. What are you waiting for?" I think sometimes we need to ask ourselves that question, or we need somebody in our lives that says, "What are you waiting for?" Think about the things that we hesitate on, that we have doubt about or fear, or we don't believe that God will help us if we make this jump. Think about the person that you believe God has led you to, but you're holding off making the decision to give that ring. Or the ring has been offered, and you're holding off because you're too afraid, you're too filled with doubt to say yes. I'm sorry for the elbow and the ribs you just received. I'm just trying to talk into your life. Don't help anybody. If you're elbowing anybody, stop it. Or think about that secret sin. Well, a lot of times you will hear from the pulpit here people sharing about secret sin in their life, or I'll be encouraging you to face that, that secret sin. Nobody knows about it, and you keep going back to it, and you hate yourself for it, and you don't want to do it, but you just keep falling back into it, especially when things get stressful and tired, and you know the step you need to make, but you just won't make it, and you need somebody to say, "What are you waiting for?" Or maybe you're thinking about having kids and you're afraid. You're afraid, what will it cost? How will we do this? How will we handle it? I don't know if I have the energy. I don't know if we're ready for it. or the opportunity that God has given. You've prayed about starting that business or making that step in your career, and the opportunity has opened up, but all of you're standing there and you're not sure if you want to make it. The doubt and the fear and the concerns and the unknown, and you're standing there and you won't jump. And you're like, what are you waiting for? You know, we've been talking about how we reach people around us, the people God has brought into our lives that are not followers of Jesus. And we said, you know, that's the three I's: intercede, invite, and or intercede and be involved and invite. And you've been praying, you've been interceding for people, and you've been involved in their life, but you're stuck. And what about that invite? Inviting those people into a conversation about who Jesus is, and is heaven real? Is hell real? Is the Bible trustworthy? Those kinds of conversations that help people begin to think about having faith in Jesus. And what are you waiting for? Or serving. You'll hear all the time about using your gifts. God has specifically gifted you with abilities and skills and passions that he has for you to use to serve him and serve others. And opportunities come up, and that sense of whenever you hear me talking about it like I am now, you go, yeah, I know I'm supposed to, but you're not taking that step. What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for to jump in and get involved and use the gift that God, or gifts that God has given you? Or that difficult conversation. You know, that one that you're going to have to touch on. It might blow up. It's going to make you feel awkward. You're going to have to talk about things that feel very awkward to you and are hard to talk about, or it's conflict. You know, that conversation that you need to have with your parents, or you need to have it with your kids, or your boss, or your employee, whatever that person is, your neighbor, and you're like, you keep getting there, but then you back away. You keep getting there, but then you back away. Or for some of you sitting here, it's that decision about putting your trust in Jesus, to follow him, to surrender yourself to him, to accept that his death and resurrection, as we celebrated today, and thank you, Amber, for leading us, that as we celebrated, he took our place on the cross to pay for our sins so that God could extend to us the forgiveness of sins, fully paid for by Christ, and now forgiven and adopted into his family. And you keep hearing this message about having faith, and you're standing there thinking, I should, but the doubt and the fear and the unbelief stops you, but what are you waiting for? And sometimes in order to grow, we need somebody to ask that question for us. What are you waiting for? That question was asked and faced by Thomas. If you'll turn in your Bible to John chapter 20, whether it's you're watching it, reading it on the screen, or whether you have your own Bible in whatever form you have it, John, you'll join with me, John chapter 20. I want to look at Thomas. Thomas was one of the 12, was one of the disciples. And this is near the end, after Jesus has resurrected, this story that John writes in his gospel, in his book, his letter. We call it gospel, it's a letter. We call the book whatever. It's the writing of John that is included as one of the books of the Bible. John chapter 20. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So Jesus, a little bit of background, has been put on the cross. He died, was in the grave, then he rose from the dead. And the other disciples had seen him, and Jesus had shown up to the other disciples, but Thomas wasn't there. That was just before this. Thomas wasn't in the room when he showed up the first time. And so the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." You can imagine if they saw Jesus come back to life after they watched him die and saw him put in a grave, and he was there until the third day. You can imagine if they saw him alive what they are going to tell. They're telling everybody, including Thomas, one of the 12, "Jesus is alive." But Thomas said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and unless I put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe this." This is just too much, you're asking me to believe, that this man raised from the dead. And you know what? As I read this, I can understand why Thomas would doubt what they are saying. They're asking him to believe that somebody came back from the dead. Not as though this is a normal occurrence in life. Have you ever seen somebody come back from the dead? Put yourself in his place. It's reasonable until you think a little bit deeper. See, the scriptures say that Thomas, one of the 12. Now, why was that put in there? Why is it significant that Thomas is one of the 12? Well, because the 12 were the 12 apostles, the 12 that followed Jesus, the 12 that he chose, and they had a front row seat. They had backstage passes to everything that Jesus did. I mean, Thomas was there for it all. I mean, he saw Jesus walk on water. Only 12 saw it because only 12 were in the boat. But he was one of the 12. He watched Jesus walk across the lake on water. He was there picking up 12 basketfuls of bread after Jesus used a little lunch about the size of the one you just had to feed 5,000 men and then the women and children on top of that. And he was there picking up 12 basketfuls as he's like, well, this came from, where did this come from? He was there when Jesus turned the water into wine. He tasted the wine. He was there when Jesus cast demons out of people, out of the man in the Gadarenes that nobody can control. They would chain him. He'd break the chains. He saw that with his own eyes. You know what else he saw? He saw Jesus raise not one, not two, but at least three people from the dead. He saw it. And if that was enough, he also had this. If I could see that next slide. Thomas had Jesus sat there listening to Jesus teach the scriptures that foretold the resurrection. Jesus kept teaching about a resurrection, and he was one that heard Jesus teaching and was confused about it. But he heard about it. He sat there and listened to Jesus prophesy that in a few days, the elders are going to take me, they're going to arrest me, they're going to torture me, I'm going to die, but on the third day, I'll raise from the dead. At least three times, Jesus said that clearly to his disciples, told them what was going to happen. In fact, the religious leaders, they heard it too, because they said, he said he would rise from the dead. But Thomas was right there listening to Jesus. He watched Jesus raise other people from the dead. He heard the friends, his friends come back to him, like his acquaintances. People were telling, oh, I've seen Jesus. Like the women that saw him after the tomb and the two that were disciples that were on the road to Emmaus, they came back and said, Jesus, we saw him. He's alive from the dead. And he had his 10 other best friends because Judas had hanged himself, but the other 10 told him, we have seen him arrive from the dead. He had all of that, and yet he said, I will not believe. Unless I see it, unless I touch him, I will not believe. Well, I don't think Thomas is on solid ground here. Jesus has given him enough to believe. Because if he gets what he asked for, he doesn't need to believe anymore because it's fact, it's in front of him. Doesn't need faith if he sees Jesus and puts his hand in his side. He doesn't need faith. He doesn't need to believe. He doesn't need to trust Jesus. Because it's fact in front of him. Now, doubt is a funny thing. Doubt creeps into our minds and creates unbelief in our heart. And it pushes us away from God because we begin to doubt, like our mother Eve did, we begin to doubt the goodness of God and his reliability. And the longer, now mark my words carefully here, the longer we choose to sit in doubt and unbelief, the further away we go from God. The longer we choose to sit in doubt and unbelief. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe doubt and unbelief are very real things. I've had my battles with them. And I believe we need to take time to work through the emotions that come with doubt and the evidence we need in order to face doubt. The scriptures, the Bible and Jesus don't ask you to believe something that has no evidence to them. There's plenty of evidence for what he asks you to believe. And I believe we have to work through that. But there comes a point in our lives where we either choose to believe or we choose not to believe. And that's where Thomas is right now. He has enough evidence to believe what his friends are telling him. But he chooses not to believe it. He chooses to go maybe with his emotions, maybe with his fears, and saying, unless I see it, I'm not going to believe. Now, here's the grace of Jesus. Verse 26, a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them this time. So the 10 are there, plus Thomas, the 11 are all there. I suspect they're in the upper room. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Now, I think that's supposed to be funny. Are you kind of one of those warp people like me that likes to scare people? It kind of gives you a laugh when you scare them, you know, and they come around a corner and you, bah, and they go, ah, and, you know, you laugh at that. My mother, I don't know how she put up with me. It was fun. It's fun scaring your mother. I don't know why. It just is. And I just wonder if Jesus had that smirk. Because the doors are locked. John's saying, Jesus didn't bang at the door, let me in, let me in. They were sitting there talking, eating, whatever they're doing. And then all of a sudden, Jesus is there. Poof! And he's like, hey, peace be with you. While they're going to change their tunics. I think it's meant to be funny. At least, I find it funny. And then Jesus turns to Thomas. Put your finger here. So I assume he offers his hand. They probably nailed Jesus in the wrist or right in the hand. Not likely the hand because it would rip away the wrist. So he would put out his hands and say, here, reach out your hand. Now touch, see that? Touch it. And now here, touch my side. Stop doubting and believe. Now this is a command. This isn't, you know, you don't need to doubt anymore. It's you stop doubting and believe. You choose now to stop doubting and believe. I've given you all the evidence, and now I'm standing here. It's time for you to stop doubting and believe. It is something that Jesus expects Thomas to choose. I think it's something he expects us to choose. What are you waiting for? In your life, where fear and unbelief and doubt is filling that empty spot, why are you waiting to believe in Jesus? Why are you waiting to believe his word to you? Now, I don't want to be too hard on Thomas because I just came through the same thing. So I shared with you that my son is going through a court case, has been for 5 years, to get time with his daughter from an estranged relationship. And for 5 years now, we have been in this process, and it's been long. And it's up and down, and we've prayed, and we've sought God, and we've had people praying for the situation. They've been in and out of court, and it's been costing an incredible amount of money. And I was okay for 4 years, but then in the fall this year, we were set to go to a court date, a court case that would finally be, all the foolishness was done. It had to move forward, and it was at the point where it's like, yeah, we're going to finally move forward now. And 3 times in a row, he showed up at court, and they canceled the court date. 3 times. And you can imagine the emotional preparation and the prayer that we went into, to praying over our son and praying for the situation, and our expectations were rising, and then boom, and then again, and then boom, and then again, and then boom. And so finally, by the time December rolled around, I could hardly pray. And in my heart were doubt and unbelief. And this is what I was saying to God. If you really loved my son and my granddaughter, you would be doing something. You would not let this happen. All the time, all the energy, all the money, all the emotions that we have poured into this, and it just keeps getting delayed. Do you not love him? And then I began to wonder, can you even do anything about this? Now, this is a battle for me. I'm beginning to doubt God. And here's why. We're never supposed to have faith in the outcome of a situation, because what we pray for, what I was praying for, may not have been the best. I'm not all wise. I'm not all knowing. Just because I was praying for something, I don't say, God, I believe you will make it happen. Well, how do I know what I'm praying for is the best thing? My faith is not in I get the answer I'm praying for. My faith is that in that God is loving, and that he is in control, and that he will bring what is best for my granddaughter and my son and my wife and myself and my family. And that even if I'm off base asking for something that isn't the best, because God is loving, whatever happens, he will work it and make sure that what is best for all of us will take place. That's where my faith is. Not my faith in, oh God, you'll do what I'm praying for, but God, you will be true to your love, and you will be true to your word and your control in this situation, and therefore I trust your love. I trust you as Lord, and I didn't. That's where I was falling. Because in long since, the things I'd prayed for had stopped from happening. Those due dates had long passed. And now I got to the point where I was beginning to doubt if God even loved us, or if he could do anything. Then, just a couple weeks ago, later January, another court case. Sure, as if it's going to happen. That was my attitude going into it. Well, it happened. And a new judge came. And the judge residing over it looked at the whole case and said, this has gone on too long. This will be resolved by the fall. This child needs time with her father. Boom. It all, everything we had prayed for, everything we had hoped for, even everything we'd asked for, not everything, God changed some things, but God, in one court case, in one day, bam, laid it right there. So I had to go back to God. And I feel such deep sorrow and regret that I did not have the faith in God to carry me through those final months. Then I read verses like in Romans. Crystal said, you know, in Romans it said, Abraham was strengthened in his faith. You know how long Abraham waited for God to give him his son? 25 years. And his wife, he was 100 when Isaac was born, and Sarah was 75. And it says in Romans, he was strengthened in his faith while he waited, while I was wilting in my faith. And so I can't be too hard on Thomas because I did the same thing. And then Thomas says to him after touching his, my Lord and my God, and Jesus says to him, because you have seen me, you have now believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. And that's why I feel such regret and kind of loss, because once it happened, I didn't need faith anymore, but I had the opportunity to trust God, and I wavered. And it wasn't because I didn't have enough knowledge or evidence that God is alive and that he loves me. It's not like I didn't have the cross. It's not like I didn't have the word. It's not like I haven't had years of walking with Jesus and watching him fill my life. I had all that, and yet in that moment, I chose to neglect that and said, until I get what I want, I will not believe. Now, the reason John writes this, he says in the next verses. Now, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded here, but these are written. I didn't need to tell you everything. I've told you this, but these are written that you may believe Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have faith in his name. He's going, I could have told you a whole lot more, but I've told you enough, enough for you to believe. So what are you waiting for? So what are you waiting for? For those of you that are not followers of Jesus, what are you waiting for? I understand. Don't get me wrong. I understand you need to think it through. You need to understand it. You need to see the evidence for it. Jesus expects you to go through that process. Are you going through it? Are you calling out on him? Are you reading the word to get the evidence? Are you talking to people, asking them questions? Are you reading books that will help you understand the things that are holding you up? The evidence is there, but if you're not looking into it, you're choosing doubt and choosing unbelief instead of faith. You are choosing that by the actions. And so I say, what are you waiting for? Talk to the people that you know that are followers of Jesus. Look into the Word. Ask God to show you. Keep coming to worship and to hear. And ask God to say, help me understand. Because there is enough evidence to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that his death on the cross paid for your sin, and that if you would surrender your life to him in true faith, that you will be forgiven and given eternal life and a relationship with God. There is enough evidence that supports that. So what are you waiting for? But what about those of you that are followers of Jesus? What are you waiting for? What sin do you need to bring to people to get help with? What money do you need to give to God that you have been holding back? What relationship do you need to step out of because it's damaging your life and your faith and your walk with God? Or what relationship do you need to step deeper into because you've been holding back or resisting? What thing do you need to go and apologize for? What person do you need to bring and lay it all down at the feet of Jesus because it's just broken and you don't know where to go and you need to take a step toward God and say, show me what I need to do? What ministry opportunity do you need to step into and stop being resisting the whisper of the Spirit in your soul where God is saying, use the gift. I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I've got time. I don't know if people will like me there. Why are you choosing not to? What are you waiting for? Usually when we doubt unbelief, it's because we're saying to ourselves, I want more, or I want better time, or I want less pain. I want more pleasure before I make that step. I want more evidence before I make that choice. I want more in my life before I'm ready to go this next step. Or this is not a good time. I want a better time, a better time that I can work this all out, a better time in my life, a better time in my family, a better time in my business, a better time in my stage of life, whatever it is. Or I want less. This is costly. This is going to, this to take this step, to trust Jesus in this and to take this step and to make the leap. Well, if I do this, then it's going to be really costly. Cost me with my family, or it's going to cost me with my business, it's going to cost me with my friendships and my relationships and my reputation. And usually because of those reasons, that's why we're doubting and that's why there's unbelief. Now again, don't get me wrong, doubt and unbelief are very real things. I get it. They creep into our soul and they push us away from God. They have to be dealt with. We have to work through the emotions. We have to get the evidence. But are you doing that? Because Jesus also says that doubt and unbelief are a choice. And sometimes we're demanding evidence or demanding results that Jesus is never going to give us. You have enough. And so, like the words of that wise philosopher that was standing behind me on that pile of lumber, what are you waiting for? So I leapt. Because I asked myself, what am I waiting for? Why am I letting fear stop me? What are you waiting for? We will never grow. We will never grow until we're willing to exercise faith in what Jesus is calling us to do. Write that down. You will never grow, I will never grow until I'm willing to exercise faith in what Jesus is calling me to do. Let's pray. Jesus, you're good. I just thank you for your mercy to Thomas and to me, that when we have doubted you, you still kept whispering and calling. And that you have been faithful, faithful to your word and faithful to your love to us, faithful to your calling in our lives. And then when you call us to make those steps, you'll be faithful if we'll trust you. And so I want to pray for your people here who are struggling with fear and doubt and unbelief. They know you're calling them to a step in a relationship, a step in their finances, a step in an action or in a command that you've given, a step of obedience to believe. I pray you would give them the grace and the strength to trust you and to take that leap, that they may grow and experience a depth of your love and of your grace that they have never before experienced. Grant them the courage, God, to choose to believe you and take that step. May growth result in our lives because we have the kind of faith that we are willing to put our trust in you, to obey the commands that you've given us, to obey the leadings that you've brought in our life, to face our doubts and our fears, and to choose you instead. And then your name, in the name, your name who died for us and who expressed your love, greatest love that could be, that you gave your life for us, we put our trust in.